This is the Everything Financial Radio Podcast. Have a terrific program lined up for you once again this week. Joining me momentarily will be Mr. Steve Hochberg. Steve is the Chief Market Analyst for Elliott Wave International. I caught up with him this past week to get his take on where the markets are headed. Steve makes some very interesting points talking about the extreme similarities between today's economic environment and the economic environment that existed at the beginning of the Great Depression. You'll want to not only stay tuned for that, but pay close attention to what Steve has to say. And then also joining me on the podcast today, Mr. David Skorica. David is the author and publisher of the Addicted to Profits newsletter. David was on the program 3 or 4 months ago and correctly predicted the market activity we've seen so far this year. So we'll get an update from David as well. If you're not yet a subscriber to my weekly newsletter, it is free. It's titled Portfolio Watch, and in Portfolio Watch, each week I discuss what's going on in the economy and the markets and what it might mean for your investments and give you some additional thoughts to consider. The newsletter is delivered to you via email every Monday after market close. To get a free subscription, simply visit yourportfoliowatch.com. The website, again, to visit to get your free subscription is yourportfoliowatch.com. I am pleased to have as a first-time guest on the Everything Financial Radio program, Mr. Steven Hochberg. Steven is Chief Market Analyst with Elliott Wave International. He is also the co-editor of the Elliott Wave Financial Forecast. And, Steve, it's a pleasure to have you on the program. Welcome.
Well, thanks. I appreciate it.
Steve, let me jump right in because you had quoted here probably about a month ago. I would compare what's going on now with the onset of the Depression period in the late 1920s and early 1930s. The potential is for it to be a lot worse simply because the amount of credit outstanding. That's a pretty scary statement. Can you expand on that for the listeners?
Sure. I mean, it's a rare event that occurs throughout not only our history, but throughout man's history. And it's so infrequent that when it starts to show its face, when it starts to course through not only financial markets but the economy, very few people are able to recognize it because it's a whole generation prior that something like this happened. But basically, we've accumulated so much debt, not only in the U.S., but worldwide over the last 70-plus years since the last deflationary depression, that debt is now weighing on our ability to service it and pay it. And we see that manifest itself throughout a whole different variety of sectors in the financial economy, and also in the markets in general. We have about 58, give or take, trillion dollars of total credit market debt outstanding relative to a U.S. GDP of about 18 trillion. The peak reading on that came, it was about 366% of debt to GDP back in 2008, 2009, and we've kind of worked a little bit off, but it's three times what it was back in the 1920s when we had the last great big deflationary depression. And we're starting to see this roll throughout the economy. For example, commodities peaked in July of 2008, down over 70%. Oil peaked at $147 a barrel in July 2008. And it's down 70 to 80% from its high. The precious metals peaked back in 2011. Silver's down about 70 to 80% from its high. Gold fell about 45%. Various stock indices around the world, for example, the Euro Stock 50 index, which is 50 blue chip stocks in Europe, peaked all the way back in 2000, made a lower high in 2007, and now is declining again. Asia, the Shanghai Composite, topped in 2007. The one index that held up through this entire period was U.S. stocks, the U.S. stock market. And we think that process right now is underway where that is rolling over into a bear market. And pretty soon you're going to align all these different disparate markets, commodities, oil, precious metal stocks, in a global bear market that is going to be bigger in percentage terms, in our view, than what occurred from 2007 to 2009.
So, Steve, you know, you look at what's happened since the financial crisis in 2008, and a number of prognosticators have credited the Federal Reserve with avoiding the next Great Depression by engaging in various forms of money printing, if you will. What would you respond to someone that takes that position?
Well, let's look at the history, because it's very recent. So back in when Lehman went bankrupt, actually, back in 2008, they started expanding their base money supply. And then they added that on with various QEs after that. And during that time, commodities have crashed. Oil has crashed. The precious metals have crashed. And we've had this massive wave of deflation sweeping across the globe. So we've had not only the Federal Reserve, but the U.S. government in terms of fiscal stimulus. So we've had record monetary and record fiscal stimulus, but we have not been able to prevent all these markets that represent, quote-unquote, inflation from crashing. And that tells us that deflation really is taking over. Not only that, but during this entire period, the annual U.S. growth in the economy, the U.S. GDP, has been under 3% now for 10 straight years. We had to go back into the 1800s, and in fact, the early 1800s, to find a comparable period where the U.S. economy was so anemic in its growth that we couldn't post a year of greater than 3% GDP. What's happening? Well, we've built up this massive amount of debt, as I said, and it's weighing on our ability to not only service it but pay it off. Now, one way or the other, it's going to be paid off. Believe me, we're going to get down to a level where we're actually able to service it through the productive capacity of what we do in our economy. But the process to get there is a painful one, and the market is going to have its day on us. And that's going to be a bear market that brings all the value of these assets down to a level where we can then wipe out some of this debt through either bankruptcy or restructuring, and then that lays the groundwork and the seed for the next great expansion of bull market. But between now and then, in our estimation, in our analysis, we're going to go through a very, very big bear market in just about all financial assets.
So we'll get your forecast in the next segment, Steve, but if you just take a look at some of the symptoms of a deflationary period, one of the things that comes to mind is we get financial institutions that fail. Are you thinking we're going to see more of the same moving ahead, referring to what happened back in 2007 and 2008?
Oh, absolutely. I do. And it won't be for the same reasons, because, you know, history repeats itself, but never so literally as to enrich historians. I mean, so the same tenor of the times and the same credit implosion will occur, but it's not going to originate in mortgages like it did in 2008. Now, one of the obvious candidates is the oil sector and the oil patch right now, but I think it's even broader than that. I think there's a whole host of assets out there that aren't worth what people think they're worth, whether they're housing stock or oil assets or some whatever has been lent against. So I think it's going to be a little bit broader this time, and you're not going to be able to pinpoint one thing that the media will focus in on as so-called causing it. I think really what's causing it is just a change in social mood, a change in psychology in mass, and we're moving from a period of extreme optimism that really manifests itself in the 80s and the 90s when we had that huge bubble and that mania. And it's been transitioning from this optimistic period that's held up for the last 10 or 15 years into a more pessimistic period where people pull back, they don't expand as much as they used to, asset prices get revalued to the downside, and that's what a bear market is. And it's as natural as a bull market. I mean, there's no bull markets, you know, and bear markets follow each other like night and day. And as an investor, it's up to us to kind of recognize which period we're in so that we can kind of avoid the bad part of it, so to speak.
Well, we're chatting today with Mr. Steve Hochberg. Steve is the chief market analyst for Elliott Wave International. He's also the co-editor of the Elliott Wave Financial Forecast, which I happen to read every month. Steve's also the editor of the Short-Term Update. And, Steve, if some of our listeners want to learn more about your work, what would you have them do?
Come to our website. It's www.elliottwave. That's one word, Elliott Wave. There's two L's and two T's in Elliott. elitewave.com, and we got a ton of free stuff on the website in terms of articles and free courses on Elliott Wave analysis, and you can sign up for our newsletter and check us out.
Terrific. Well, we will continue our conversation with Mr. Hochberg when Everything Financial Radio continues. Stay with us. This is the Everything Financial Radio podcast. Glad you decided to tune in today. I'm going to finish my conversation with Mr. Steve Hochberg in this segment. And let me remind you to stay tuned, because in the third segment of the podcast today, I'll be chatting with the author and publisher of the Addicted to Profits newsletter, Mr. David Skorica. I have the pleasure of chatting today with Mr. Steve Hochberg. Steve is the chief market analyst for Elliott Wave International. He's also the co-editor of the Elliott Wave Financial Forecast. And Steve, let's talk in this segment a bit more about what your specific forecast might be in various markets and how our listeners might be affected. You'd mentioned in the last segment that due to your forecast of a deflationary period that we're going to enter a significant bear market in stocks. So I know our listeners want to know your opinion. How bad is it going to get?
Well, that's a $64,000 question. Any level I give you for, say, the Dow is just going to be revised as we see the Elliott Wave structure unfold. I'll say this, in terms of overall of what we're looking for, it's a bigger percentage decline in the Dow than what occurred between 2007 and 2009. In that period, the Dow went down 54-55%. From its high in October 2007 to its low in March 2009, I think this next leg down in percentage terms is going to be bigger than that one. And it's going to be as widespread as that in terms of all assets going down. So in this environment, it's extremely, extremely difficult to invest, as you can imagine. I mean, everyone goes, where do you put your money? And so what I would say is safety is probably the first thing that we tell people with the vast majority of their money. You know, you can speculate with small portions of it as various markets move this way and that way, but for the vast majority, you got to seek out safety. And right now, the safest instruments appear to be short-dated treasury bonds, U.S. treasury bonds. That might change in the future, but at this point, and the difficult part of that is it's, you're not getting any return on your money in terms of interest or dividends on, you know, in terms of income. But sometimes it pays, and it's very rare in history, but sometimes it pays to be as safe as possible in anticipation of the next buying opportunity down the road. And that's pretty much what we're saying right now to our subscribers.
You know, Steve, when you think about market crashes, I'm reminded of the flash crash that occurred back in 87. And then if you look at a chart from really July of 2007 through March of 2009, the market went down, and there was a significant, you know, there were significant counter trend rallies along the way. Any ideas to how this bear market unfolds?
Not the exact specifics, because everyone is a little bit different. I'll say this in general. Bear markets tend to unfold faster than bull markets. And the reason being is because a bull market is driven by the emotion of hope. And hope dissipates very diffusely. And we've seen that in the rolling tops that we've had, where the transports topped in December of 2014, you know, and then the Dow, and then the secondary indexes, and they all kind of roll over. Bear markets, however, are driven by the emotion of fear. And fear is a very sharp emotion. That's why bear markets tend to unfold very quick, and they catch people by surprise. So it's difficult to try to catch every swing in a bear market, which is why the majority of your money should be out of the market in safe, short-term cash instruments or cash equivalents. And if you see rallies like we're getting now from the February low and the January low, you know, these are opportunities to either lighten up your portfolio or maybe get bearish in some sort of speculative type of instrument to play for another wave to the downside.
So, Steve, I know you track investor sentiment. What changes have you seen or shifts in investor sentiment since the first of the year?
Going into the high, I mean, we had record levels of optimism, and not only levels, but the duration of the optimism was years on end, which sets up the bear market. You need that optimism, people believing that we just hang on and buy and hold and just hold, we can ride this out. That is the kind of sentiment that sets up the bear market. And since then, we had a decline into August of last year. Sentiment got very pessimistic on a short-term basis. Then we had a counter-trend rally into November of last year, but didn't make a new high in the Dow and the S&P. And then the markets rolled over and made a low in January, February this year. Sentiment got pretty pessimistic on a short-term basis, which is why we're seeing this rebound now. And I'm looking at sentiment. My latest figures are pretty much neutral right now. They haven't really told me anything in terms of whether this rally is about to end or we can go a little bit higher. But I suspect that, you know, once we exhaust this bounce that we're seeing, whether it's a week, 2 weeks, a month, we'll have to look at the pattern and see. We're going to roll over and go back down again. And I expect that sentiment will get pessimistic as we work our way to the downside, kind of a stay in a very pessimistic range until we get to really historic extremes in terms of pessimism and duration of pessimism, which will give us an idea that we're getting close to a low.
Steve, we have time for one more topic briefly. When we were talking in the last segment about all the debt that exists, and essentially if there's too much debt to be paid, it won't all get paid. It'll have to be dealt with likely through defaults, bankruptcies. When you look at U.S. government debt in the $19 trillion range, what's your longer-term forecast for U.S. government bonds in light of the fact that that's a pretty big number as well?
It's huge. There's so many dynamics working there. I think if you look back at the last deflationary depression we had in the 20s, and you look back at the U.S. Government bond market, to the extent that we didn't have 30-year Treasury bonds, but we had 10-year bonds and so forth, during the deflation, they had a big spike up in yields. They jumped really high as people became afraid that the U.S. government was not going to honor their debt. And then as the deflation intensified, yields came back down. And I think we're going to have a replay kind of that scenario where U.S. Treasury yields spike to the upside, deflation starts intensifying, and then yields come back down and may even make new lows thereafter. The problem we're having is the U.S. Fed is talking about going down the path of this insanity from Europe and Asia, where they have negative interest rates. You know, they've actually charging you to buy one of their bonds, and people are doing it because they think rates are going to get even more negative. But if you buy these bonds and hold them to maturity, you're guaranteed a loss. I mean, it's just absolutely insane, and they're painting themselves into this horrible corner that they're not going to be able to get out of. If rates ever went negative in the U.S., the only thing to own at that point is greenbacks, is dollars, or gold. And so it's something we're going to – it's not there yet. We're not there yet. Asia's there. Parts of Europe are there. The U.S. has kind of been pushing back against it. But if we ever get to that point, it's going to be a terrible situation for U.S. savers. It's going to be difficult to even – hold on to whatever investment you have, and at that point you just want to get a safety deposit box and take your greenbacks and put them in a safety deposit box.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Our guest today has been Mr. Steve Hochberg. He is with Elliott Wave International, and you can Google Elliott Wave International and find his site. And Steve, we thank you for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
I'll be back in the next segment with Mr. David Skarica.
Give me your money.
Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio podcast. I'm your host, Dennis Tubergen. Before I get to my conversation with David Skarica, let me remind you that the revised edition of the new Retirement Rules book has just become available this past week on March the 3rd. If you'd like to get a copy, you can just simply visit Amazon and order the conventional print version or get the Kindle version. I'm pleased to have back on the Everything Financial Radio program after about a three-month hiatus, Mr. David Skarica. Dave is the author of Addicted to Profits. He is also the author of Bear Market Rising, available on Amazon. And his website is addictedtoprofits.net. And Dave, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
We're going to have to take a minute here and say, see, I told you so, because you were on the program a few months ago, said at that time that you saw dwindling participation in the market. The market was making newer highs, not all-time highs. And as it did, you said there's not as much participation. You expected to see the market take a tumble, and that's exactly what happened the first part of the year. How does that feel?
Good, because I've been waiting for that for a while. Because if you actually go look at the brass of the market, it actually peaked in the summer of 2014. And the problem is, as I say, this is an art, not a science, and usually brass does peak before the market itself. But you don't know how long the lag can be. Like, for example, in 1987, before the crash, it was only a few months, the lag, before the market crashed. In the case of 99 to 2000, the tech bubble and bear market, it was kind of similar today where, you know, it took over a year for the market to top out after the breath topped. So it was just very difficult, especially when you're on the short side, which I've kind of been doing for about a year and a half now. I've been shorting stocks. It's very difficult to, to do this and try to time it properly, especially if you're using put options and things of this nature. But, you know, it felt good that finally this came down. And what you saw was really simple, that, you know, the so-called FANG stocks, they finally got hit in January with everything else. And because they had represented so much of the market gains or so much of the market holding up, that finally when they got hit, everything else kind of fell with it.
David, when you just take a look at margin debt also, to what extent do you think margin debt accumulation attributed to the market rise?
Well, that's a huge factor. If you actually take a chart of margin debt, a percentage of GDP or percentage of the market or, you know, the actual nominal figure, you'll see we're basically where we were at the 2007 and 2000 top. It's basically an inverse indicator of sentiment. And that, I think, really led to it, a large part of the decline, because you would think that a lot of this margin debt is probably in, you know, the high flyers. People are owning Google or Amazon or stocks of this nature kind of on margin. So you would think that then, you know, when those stocks dropped 100 points in, you know, 3 weeks, that, you know, you would start seeing margin calls, and you got to sell other things to meet your margin calls on those stocks, and then it kind of all cascades down. But, you know, the margin debt is still very high by historical standards, even with the recent decline in stocks. And what's interesting as an indicator is once it starts to tick down off those highs, and this happened in both 2000 and 2007, that is actually a sign that the market is essentially top, because people are already been as leveraged as it can be leveraged, and you will see the market continuing lower in the coming year or 2 years or however long the bear market is. So, you know, I would expect that you are going to see a reaction rally, but, you know, I would think it's just a bear market rally, and usually what you look for is the market to rally back up to the 150 or 200-day moving average, which in a nutshell is roughly about 2,000 on the S&P. So I don't know if we'll get that high, but we could definitely get into the late 1900s, I think, you know, and then we would roll over again. And as a note, February is always the biggest month for stock buybacks. The reason being is, you know, when you buy back the stock, you reduce the number of shares outstanding and inflate your EPS. So by buying back the most amount of stock in February, companies can essentially then beat the earnings numbers for the year more easily. So February, ever since this kind of cheap money bubble started in about 2011, 2012, has always been an up month because of the buybacks kind of driving stock prices higher. So I would expect that once you get through February into March and April, you can see maybe a decline in starting in the late first quarter into the second quarter.
So, David, there's an old market adage that says, as January goes, so goes the year. Do you think that will hold true this year?
Yeah, and actually, if you want another, I think that's about an 80% accurate indicator. It's not as good on downside yet markets, but it's still over 50, 60. And then, you know, as kind of a fun indicator, you've got the Super Bowl indicator, and, you know, you had an underdog team, which is, you know, the AFC, which is the bear part of that indicator, win this year, too. And that kind of adds fuel to the fire of the bears. I mean, actually, ironically, even though it really got really means nothing, the Super Bowl indicator actually has about 80% accuracy. So that also kind of helps the bear case too, if you want something kind of like a little lighter for that. But mostly I'm looking at things like margin debt. And another really interesting indicator is market cap to GDP. This is Warren Buffett's favorite indicator. So when you take the total market cap divided by GDP as a percentage, and really there's only two other times in history where it went over 100%, and that was the dot-com bubble when it went to an incredible 150% of GDP. It went to 110% during the housing bubble, and it went to about 125% during this bubble. And the median is about 70%. So usually stocks are roughly 7/10, so two-thirds the size of the economy, and we got up to, you know, over 100%. So even with this decline, I think we're about 100%. So we still have a long way to fall by that kind of indicator. So these are not the kind of indicators you can do trading on, but they're just kind of give you a long-term perspective of where the market is. And another interesting indicator is median price to sales. So it's basically the average price to sales, not price to earnings, but price to sales of the companies. And the median means half the companies are below it or half the companies are above it. And the median price to sales on the S&P is actually higher than it was in 2000. So the market is actually incredibly expensive. Price to earnings don't tell the whole story because there's so much financial engineering going on in companies using debt to buy back their own stock that it's distorting what real earnings are. You look at stock like IBM. IBM is a terribly fundamentally flawed company, but they have a price to earnings ratio of 9 because all they do is buy back their own stock, you know? And I actually think that it's kind of like a balance sheet bubble, that because these companies are using debt to do this because they can borrow so cheaply, that is something that really blow up. And that will lead ultimately to this big demise in the stock market because when it really falls, because what will happen is these buybacks aren't done for, you know, giving back to shareholders. That's a spin. They're done so activist investors can get a couple more percent return on their stock, and number one. And number two, they're done to basically to trigger either stock options or cash options of the management of these companies. So that's why they're done. And once you fall enough, well, you know, hedge funds will all be down, so it won't matter. And then these companies will be so far underwater on their stock options, it won't matter. And you'll see the buyback stop. That's essentially, actually, by the way, what happened in 2009. And what's interesting is these companies are the worst timers of their own stock. They all buy back at tops, and they all stop their buybacks at market bottoms because the buybacks aren't above, you know, buying back the stock cheap. They're about management making money for themselves.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there for this segment. Our guest today is Mr. David Skorica. He is the author of the Addicted to Profits newsletter. You can get more information at addictedtoprofits.net. He's also got a book available on Amazon called Bear Market Rising. I'd encourage you to check it out. I will continue my conversation with David when Everything Financial Radio returns. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio podcast. This is Dennis Tubergen. Quick reminder, if you're not yet a subscriber to my newsletter, Your Portfolio Watch, you can subscribe by visiting yourportfoliowatch.com, enter your name and email address, and every Monday after market close, you'll get a summary and analysis of what's going into the markets, what's going on in the economy, and how it might affect you and your money. The website, again, yourportfoliowatch.com. I'm pleased to have on the Everything Financial Radio program today Mr. David Skorica. We've been chatting with David about the U.S. stock market. We'll continue that conversation in this segment and talk a bit about what's going on in the world economically speaking. Let me remind you, if you're just joining us, that David is the author of the book Bear Market Rising, available on Amazon. And his newsletter is Addicted to Profits. You can get more information at addictedtoprofits.net. And David, in the last segment, we were chatting about the U.S. stock market. And in this segment, let's start out by talking about something that maybe a lot of listeners don't understand, something called negative interest rates. Europe has had negative interest rates since 2014. Japan has just gone to negative interest rates. For our listeners that may not be familiar with what that means, could you explain?
Yeah, negative interest rates are quite simply is when you're essentially paying the issuer the bond for the right to own that bond, right? So instead of like you buying a government bond and say getting 1%, say you got $1 million and you buy a bond for 1%. Well, that 1% means you should get $10,000 a year. If the rate is negative 1%, you're paying $10,000 a year for the right to own that bond. Well, and the idea behind it is really us depositors aren't doing that. And most these negative rates are basically rates that say these big banks are getting, to hold the money with the Japanese or European central banks. So what the idea behind them would be is like, Credit Suisse or Deutsche Bank or, Mitsubishi Bank, which is a bank in Japan, they don't want to then own bonds or own money at an account in Europe or Japan, and then they're going to turn around instead of putting that money there and parking it there and getting, 0.1% or 0.5% on a short-term bond. They're going to turn around and go speculate with it or go, okay, we're not going to take this $1 billion and put it with the Bank of Japan. We're going to go take this $1 billion and loan it out to, for housing loans or, go speculate with it in the stock market. So what they're trying to do is make people take risks with that money and or even trying to devalue their currency, thinking that, everyone's going to dump those bonds or, not want to be in the Japanese yen if we're yielding negative, and then that terms can make the yen weak, and then we can turn export for cheap and help our own economy out. So that's kind of the idea behind it. And something like $2 trillion of worldwide government debt was in negative interest rates before the Japanese went, and because the Japanese is the second largest bond market in the world, and they have debt to GDP of 250%, when their 10-year bond went negative, and it is negative as we're doing this interview still, so that exploded from 2 or 3 trillion to almost 10 trillion. So that really seemed to put this fuel in the fire actually for gold and precious metals. Because now you're like, you're the second biggest debtor in the world. And Japan, by the way, is the second biggest debtor in the world by far. They're way ahead of Germany or China or these other large, or Italy and these other large indebted countries. So when that happened, it almost seemed to flush all this money into gold and precious metals, because even though gold and precious metals don't yield anything, it's a protection, against the devaluation of paper money. And why would you want to own a Japanese bond at negative 0.05% when, gold and precious metals at least can go up in value and protect you against this kind of money printing madness of the central banks? But we understand what's really interesting about these negative interest rates, they crush the banks, because banks make money off a steepening yield curve. So even if rates are zero in Japan, and say when the 10-year bond was 0.5%, which it was about a year ago, the curve is steep. The short end is zero, the long end is 0.5%, and the banks can make money off that spread. But now when you've got the short end at negative 0.2 and the long end at negative 0.05, and there's no spread, all of a sudden, these banks can't make any money. So you've seen the Japanese banks, you've seen the European banks, all the places where they have negative interest rates, they can't make any money off interest spreads, and it's absolutely crushing them. So that is really an interesting thing going forward. And, of course, it crushes, like the insurance industry, which will buy long-term bonds to get yield to basically pay off insurance claims. So that's the argument, by the way, because the financial industry in the United States, in terms of insurance and all these sort of things, so much bigger than these other countries. That's the argument that really the Fed is going to have a difficult time going negative, because you're going to crush all these financially based industries if you do that.
So, David, essentially, why would you put money in a bond, which pretty much when you buy it means you've got a guaranteed loss, when you could put money into something tangible like gold or silver and at least have a chance to preserve your capital or make some money potentially. So do you see that as these negative interest rates around the globe intensify, do you see that as being bullish for both gold and silver?
Yeah, I think both cases are going to be bullish. Here's the funny thing about it is that people people think that if interest rates go up, that's bearish for gold and silver. That's not true, because in the 70s, rates went up the entire decade and gold and silver went up. Because remember, when rates go up, you lose money on the coupon of the bond. So if rates go up 10%, then basically that bond might go down 10% in price, and you still might want to be in gold and silver because you're losing money on the actual value of the bond, even though the rate of the bond is going higher. So I see it bullish both ways, because on the one hand, why you're going to want to be in gold and silver over having to pay the issuer of the bond for the right to own that bond. So yeah, gold and silver makes sense. And then when these rates finally do reverse course, if you own the bond, the price of the bond is going to get hammered, and you rather own gold and silver in that environment too, because you're basically at the top of kind of an international global sovereign debt bubble. Now, right now I'm taking it one thing at a time. I think in the short term it's positive for gold, because I don't see the negative interest rates going away in the short term. But what I foresee happening is that we probably have the corporate debt bubble. Like I mentioned, the stock buyback, you know, we got bubbles in energy debt, we got bubbles in emerging market debt that's issued in U.S. dollars. I see all that kind of corporate debt blowing up first, and the sovereign debt will probably stay low in yield or negative in yield during that, and that will cause this run into gold and silver. And then part two of the run in gold and silver, which is probably a couple of years away, will be finally when these highly indebted nations, Japan and Italy, would probably look like the two that could blow first. When their bond markets blow up, then you would see another run into gold and silver, because no one will trust kind of like sovereign debt. So I think we've got a two-pronged effect here where, you know, you've got this negative interest rate, help people push into gold, and then those negative rates are ultimately going to lead to a bubble in sovereign debt and a blow-up in sovereign debt, and that will again put people into gold. They won't trust government debt around the world. And you got to remember, like, no one really talks about this because the growth has been much better over the last 7 years, but actual debt to GDP, if you take in count states and the local government, the U.S. is actually not much better than Italy. Italy is 130% of GDP, which, by the way, is where Greece was, right, when Greece started their debt crisis in 2010. And the United States, including the state and municipal level, is about 125%. So we're very close, in my opinion, to the tipping point. But first things first, we probably have negative rates in government debt for the short and foreseeable future. And then after that, we're going to get the blow up in the corporate bond market. And then you'll probably get the blow up in the sovereign bond market. Because if you remember, just quick note here to end off on this, when the pig countries, when Portugal, Italy, Greece, Spain, when they all kind of blew up in 2009, 10 to 2012, when their yields spiked, what happened was their bonds went up with all other sovereign bonds in 2008 during the financial crisis. But then they all sold off hard when there's a pair of these countries with serious, serious growth and debt problems. So same thing will happen now. Italy, Japan will probably, you know, remain negative in the case of Japan, remain low in the case of Italy during any kind of downturn in the global economy. But when you get out of that downturn, what's going to happen is, you know, it's the old saying that when the ocean goes out, you see who's naked. You're going to see the weakest player, and you're going to see those sovereign bond markets really, really, really get whacked. And one thing that's going to escalate the problem in places like Italy is their banking sector has got a lot of problems with upwards of 15 to 20% of non-performing loans at a lot of Italian banks. And, you know, Italy's already got this huge debt to GDP. Well, what happens if they have to bail out these banks? You know, then you're talking Italy gets up to where Greece is now at 180% of GDP. That's probably when all hell breaks loose there. So, definitely negative rates helps gold, but I think it's going to be a very quick bubble. We're going to go from these negative rates to these sovereign bond markets actually falling apart in a couple of years.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Our guest today has been Mr. David Skorica. The website is addictedtoprofits.net. David, thank you for joining us. Love to have you back.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Well, that's our program for this week. Hope you got something you can use. Joining me on next week's program, Mr. Jeff Deist, president of the Mises Institute and former chief of staff for Congressman and former presidential candidate Ron Paul. He'll have some great things to say, so you won't want to miss that. I'll be back again next week. Talk to you then.